you're about to make a trade. Which you do you listen to? Is it, get optioning those options? Or let's do a little research. Learn more at finra.org/tradesmart.
Marshall's buyers are hustling hard to get amazing new gifts into stores, right up to the last minute. Like a designer perfume for that friend who never RSVP'd. Wishlist topping toys for her kids who came too. Mm-hmm. Belgian chocolates for the neighbor. A cozy scarf for your boss. And a wool jacket for your husband that you definitely did not almost forget. Marshalls. We get the deals. You get the good stuff. Even at the last minute. Whew. Find a Marshalls near you.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox. Welcome to the award-winning FCPA Compliance Report, the oldest podcast in compliance. Today, we continue our special four-part seminars of webinars I did with representatives from Diligent. These webinars are a great way for us to end 2025 and look into 2026. Over this four-part series, we'll look at due diligence, FCPA, export control, and sanctions under the Trump administration. I know you will get a lot out of this four-part podcast series in December, so I hope you'll listen to the entire series. Today, I'm joined by Stephanie Font as we take a look at Beyond Borders, Trade Sanctions, and Export Controls. Each of these podcasts come in at just under an hour. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, and I'm absolutely thrilled today to be here with Stephanie Font from Diligent, and we're going to visit with you today about perhaps the most dynamic compliance topic and challenge we've seen in 2025, and that's saying a lot. Our title is Beyond Borders, Navigating Export Control, Sanctions, and Vendor Risk in a Changing Regulatory Landscape. As I mentioned, my co-host for this event is Stephanie Font. So if we can go to the next slide, Jen. Stephanie, I'm going to ask you to tell our audience what your current role at Diligent is, but equally importantly to me and interestingly is you have a very extensive background in due diligence, and I've had the opportunity to visit with you several times over the past few years, and you started out really at the base of doing due diligence. So to me, that has given you a great insight into what's the spade work you have to do, but now in your new role, you're looking at a much bigger picture. Could you tell us what your current role is and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. As always, great to be with you, Tom. My current role at Diligent is I work in the due diligence organization, and my team is responsible for the methodology and our processes behind our research and the elements and the different scopes that we provide in due diligence and assuring that all of those align with regulatory expectations. And then in addition to that is training the teams, providing any kind of instruction and guidance, and also helping clients with their processes. But historically, I started almost 14 years ago with Steel as a research analyst in due diligence. And I have worked both on the open source as well as the field investigation side, and then moved into more of the training role and then even broader into my current role with more of the regulatory piece. And back in those days, we were focused on a much smaller set of things than we are now.
So, Jen, if we could go to the next slide, which is my contact information, and then follow up from here to the next one. And this really here's our agenda. And we're going to talk about, has due diligence changed in 2025 and maybe bleed over into where it may go in 2026, BIS and export control compliance. The third section, I tried to figure out a title and I just decided it's all things China, at least from the export control perspective. And then a very interesting section on DOJ data security requirements that Stephanie is really going to educate us on. And we hope to conclude with, be ready for more change in 2026. If we could go to the next slide, Jen. Here is our first polling question. And I'm going to go ahead and read these, and we're going to give you guys about a minute to answer them. Where would you place your organization today on its export control and sanctions maturity journey? So is it tech-based, Are you interested in solution-based? Are you interested in an integrative approach of compliance solution tech and services? Or do you want to take your export control program in a really different direction? We will have some polling in progress. I'm going to be interested in this, Stephanie, because in your background, you talked about being actually a research analyst in due diligence. And as we've then moved to a sort of a tech-based solution, I'm almost of the opinion that in 2025 and going into 2026, we may be moving back towards sort of your roots as a research base, or at least a research and tech component. So we'll see really what our listeners think about this. And let me just have that conversation with you, Stephanie. Are you seeing really an evolution where you started with research, we moved to tech, and now it's maybe a combination of both, or is it something else?
Yeah, I think it's mostly a combination of the two, and it's having the right components of each. When you look at that, it's okay, so as long as I've got some of each, then I'm probably good. It's got to be the right pieces, right? And I also think for export controls, as we'll kind of dive into, this is one place I think that people are still learning and figuring out what solutions work best for them. And so I'll definitely be interested to see what the responses look like.
Okay, tech-based solution, nearly a third. Service-based solution, about 20% tech and services solution, almost 50%, and then a smaller on taking your export control program in a different direction. And I think provides some really interesting input. So could we go to the next slide, Jen? Before we get to this slide, Stephanie, I really want to have a conversation with you about, has anything changed? Has the definition of due diligence changed? Has something expanded? Why are we in 2025 re-emphasizing due diligence as perhaps not the critical, but one of the most critical aspects of your best practices compliance program?
Yeah, the question of has it changed? Oh, yes, by far. I think it just keeps changing. I think going into 26, I anticipate we will continue seeing changes. The big thing is that I think in 2025 is it's expanded as far as what regulations are putting that as its own expectation. Like we're starting to see it actually mentioned or having certain elements that you just have to have some due diligence incorporated in there. And that goes from where we used to always just be looking at third parties, right? And we're really looking at them and their business and what are they doing. And I think one of the things we've really seen in 2025 is this explosion of who else we should be paying attention to, right? Who else is involved? Who are the other parties involved in these third parties? And what should we look at with them? And everything from ownership, which for years now we've started implementing a lot of those things. I think it's come into even more scrutiny. And then everything from third parties to switching to end users, and not switching, I guess, adding in end users. And then you want to add in cartels, and that adds a whole other dimension. What do you think on that, Tom? Especially when you look at due diligence in a process, what do you think has changed in 25?
One of the things that's changed is on the sort of U.S. border side of things, the companies that now have to engage in substantive due diligence who may not have been required to before. Obviously, the change of cartels or redesignating them as foreign terrorist organizations put an entirely new spin on who you have to look at. And so I'm in Texas, and it's not unusual for a Texas business to have commercial relationships with a company from Mexico. You might sell into Mexico, but equally validly, you might import either finished products or part of your overall manufacturing process. Minerals or other raw materials could come in from Mexico. Now, not only do you have to look at those partners in a way you perhaps never have, but you've got to look at everyone. And I can't think of a better example than what happened late last week when the Department of Justice announced a major FCPA enforcement action. I know this is not an FCPA-based webinar, but it had the following fact pattern. A traditional FCPA case where bribes were paid, but the bribes were funded from laundered money in a bank. that was controlled by the cartels. That's an area that most anti-corruption compliance specialists had never really looked at or thought about. And the company that was engaged in the FCPA violation, there's now a potential criminal indictment involving parties in that because of the money laundering by the cartel in the bank. If you're the U.S. company that used that bank, you may now have exposure. And you probably didn't think about your banking relationships as part of your commercial operations as something you have to look at now. Now, that's an FCPA case. We haven't even got to what we're going to talk about on trade sanctions or export control, but it really demonstrated to me this broadening out of who has to look, and that's U.S. companies with commercial relationships in Mexico or other countries where cartels have been redesignated as foreign terrorist organizations, and for anyone doing business directly in Mexico or Guatemala, and that's where this FCPA case was from. It wasn't even from Mexico, Guatemala. And what happens if criminal organizations in Venezuela or Chile or Brazil receive a redesignation, which the administration has talked about doing? So I just see a whole swath of businesses on the U.S. side of things having to do due diligence, and they may never have had to other than perhaps their direct counterparties. Now they've got to do tiered down suppliers. They have to look at banks. They have to look at potentially law firms or accounting firms that they're doing business with. And if you think you're safe, how did that money get to that bank? Was it laundered money based upon drug sales? Now that may be seen as a foreign terrorist money source. It's really expanded who has to look and then where you have to look going forward. And I hope that kind of throughout this webinar, we can really try to show folks not only the dynamics of change that have happened up to Q4 2025, and how we both think those dynamics are going to continue in 2026, but what can you do to prepare yourselves for a continued series of dynamic change? You were nodding when I was talking about the FCPA enforcement action. Is that something that you all had actively discussed at Diligent of, wow, this is an area that we hadn't really thought about before, but now it's front and center?
Yeah, we've had some clients actually reach out and talk about the cartels and what they can do when they have partners in Mexico and that region in general. One of the things that we focused on, and we focused on for years, but now this just gives another example of why it's important, is the people, right? So you have your third party, you're going to go do your research on your third party, and then you have the people. So you have all of the key personnel within that third party. That's a good opportunity to also be doing research on them, because then if you're finding their other affiliations, screening them as well. So one of the things that I always like to point out to people is cartels are on the list, right? They're all on the foreign terrorist organizations, things like that. Then they're adding the people as they identify people who have major roles. Then they're also adding the people who are coming across in these money laundering schemes, et cetera. So you've got to know the people, because your third party is not going to come up as a cartel. You're not doing a business directly with them. Them themselves is not going to come up as that. But you've got to look behind. It's like peek behind the curtain, right? You've got to get those people. You've got to know that. But it goes a step further a lot of times, where you've got to know, like you're saying, you've got to know the line, right? So now we start to dive into more of even like supply chain, right? So now all of a sudden we're going in a supply chain direction and having to be researching the companies, the people, the other backgrounds behind your supply chain. And like you said, where's the money going? Where's the money coming from? Who are all the in-betweens in all of these transactions? That really complicates things when you're trying to look at your due diligence program.
You said something, Stephanie, I wanted to pick up on, which was you've had clients reach out. And I really want to use that to ask the types of services that Diligent has. Obviously, you have a tech solution, and we're going to talk about that. But what about the services part, where you have that ongoing dialogue? Is that a routine part of the business delivery from you and your team?
Yeah, so one of the things that we like to do is partner with clients when they do have a situation. In some cases, we may have something already that works for them in a due diligence investigation, but they might not know which scope is the right one to handle their needs. So sometimes it's a matter of they reach out and we can just talk about it. We can say, what is your need? What can we do to help you reach that? Or is it something we don't already offer, but we could look at doing? And so we like to have those conversations because we like to frame the things we're doing around what people really need and the risks that and concerns that they're facing. And sometimes we already have something, or we can advise them, hey, if we do it this way, or we add this to that, things like that, and really come up with a solution for them based on their exact situation.
Stephanie, now to turn to BIS and export control compliance, could I first start off by asking you, what is the affiliate rule and how does that come into play for your clients or U.S. companies?
Yeah, I'm going to start with the fact that the affiliate rule has now been suspended for a year. However, I do think that it's important that everybody take it into consideration and build it into your program going into 26 to know that you've already set yourself up. You're already making these assessments. You've got the information at hand. So with that, the affiliate rule essentially is BIS taking the export controls and modeling after the OFAC 50% rule, which we're already familiar with. It's been in place for years. But if you're not, it's essentially on OFAC, the 50% rule is if at least 50% of your owners or of the owners of your third party are blocked, and that's in total. So we're talking direct, indirect, aggregate them all together. You meet 50% of owners that are on the SDN list or the SSI list, then that third party is also blocked under those regulations. And so in the affiliate rule under BIS, they basically modeled it after the same thing, but now it's entities that are on BIS's entity list or the military end users list. And the same thing, you got to know your owners and you got to screen those owners. And then if you've got owners on those lists, you've got to do the calculations to know, did you meet the 50% threshold? Now, in this case, if they meet the 50% threshold, what does that mean for the third party? So it's not a blocking, but what it means is the most strict export regulations that apply to those owners then applies to that third party. It's really important to identify and screen those owners, do that calculation. An interesting thing with BIS, because under, say, the entity list or the military end user list, they have designations as far as what their restrictions are. And so then you have to say, okay, now I have to look at those owners and see what the relevant restrictions are, because the most strict of those is what would then apply. And it's another place where it's expanding due diligence. But I think one of the things that it really presents as a challenge is that it now we've gone from, we're just looking at our normal third parties. But when we start to go into BIS and export controls, the affiliate rule and a lot of the export controls, we're really looking at end users. So now all of a sudden, we have a different set of third parties that we're worried about that you might not have been unless you had much more high-risk exports under different parts of the export administration regulations.
So you've really gone through and answered, I think, in large part, question two, which is the compliance challenges. But let me ask you that specific question. So if any of our listeners missed that in the, kind of the first part, what are maybe two or three of the top compliance challenges does the affiliate rule? Is it this increased scope? Is it the deep dive? Is it putting it all together? All of the above? None of the above?
I think it's all of the above. I think for some, it is a level of information they've not previously sought for their end users. So they may have screened them themselves, right? So they know their end user itself is not on the entity list or who they're selling it to. A big piece with the export controls. And one of the things that BIS is looking at is that risk of diversion. So you've got that re-export, the in-country transfers, things like that. And so there's a lot more complexity as far as where things can end up that BIS is concerned about. And actually, the affiliate rule was trying to close part of that gap in the sense of, hey, if you identify the owners and they're not on the list, your risk is like lower as far as those things happening, essentially. And so they're trying to make sure that it's, hey, there's less risk of that diversion if they're not also, if those owners, et cetera, are not also not on that list. So I think the other, another key challenge is that it's another piece of due diligence that a lot of companies didn't even have. There's not, it's not even in your program, right? You might, you're probably screening directly a lot of those end users and even your intermediaries and things like that. You're probably checking them against the list. But to take that extra step and have to be like, now I have to actually know the owners of them, that takes it a whole other level, which actually requires research, because most of the time you can't just find that by, I'm just going to plug it into something and it's going to just tell me, yeah, somewhere in their complicated ownership structure, there's somebody on the entity list.
So it almost sounds like it is an educational component and then a technical component. You have to understand what your obligations are, and then you have to be able to execute on those obligations. Would that be fair?
Yes, exactly.
How does the Diligent 3 Investigative Solutions approach help a client work through these new obligations or additional obligations, if that's the more correct term?
Yeah, so the way that we built these solutions is actually to give you options. And it really depends on what relationship you have with them, what type of business they're doing, and what else is going to happen. So for instance, if you just need that ownership piece, right there, you need to identify and screen and do that calculation. We have due diligence investigations that will do just that. And then when you have the need to look at, say, the individuals that own, then we've got one that we identify, screen, and calculate that for you with the ownership. But then we're also going to add in individual owners that own 25% or more and do a principal investigation like we would in an open source investigation. So we're diving a little bit more into adverse information about those people. Then we have the option of being able to add this ownership identification, screening, and calculation onto some of our other report scopes. So one is our OSI, which is our open source investigation. So you get that full ABAC coverage. And this is where fitting it into your compliance program actually might help you in the broader sense, because when you have some of these third parties that you're like, hey, we have ABAC concerns, depending on that relationship that you have with them, you may have, hey, these are ones that come up as an ABAC concern, we need to look at that, or we need to look at their business practices for whatever reason on that. But then you need that component to know their ownership. And in our ownership, where we're identifying and screening, we're doing multiple levels. So if at all possible, we're hopefully getting to at least some of those beneficial owners when we're looking at that, and we're screening all of them. So you're getting that multi-level ownership identification and screening. So then we can make those calculations to see if you meet the 50%. In the same report, we're doing the calculation for the BIS affiliate rule, the OFAC 50 rule, and the EU 50 rule. So if you have any of those concerns, they're all in one. You're getting them all in one. You don't even have to tell us, I want this versus that. You're getting all of those in the same thing. And then we also have a BIS specialty report that's a military end user assessment. And this one's really specific to Part 744.21 of the Export Administration Regulations. And it's really looking at military end use and the concerns outlined under that regulation. But we also now have the option to add the ownership piece onto that one as well. So if you have that military end user need, then you can do that investigation with the ownership added on. So you're getting that full identification screening and that calculation against the 50% rules. And so this is, it's kind of one way of packaging in different packages, depending on your risks. And this is also one place that I think a lot of these things are converging this year, is where you have that overlap because I think that people are going to see more and more of that overlap where you have different third parties that you potentially need to address against different ones of the regulations.
Stephanie, I hope our listeners will take away at least one theme, which is the dynamicism of change that you have articulated already, but having a process in place to be able to respond to that. And as we move into 2026, we may see new geopolitical regions have these sorts of designations. I've already mentioned potentially Guatemala and Brazil and other Latin American countries, but equally we could have from other continents, Asia Pacific, Africa, perhaps the Middle East. And so would the processes you've described, particularly in the Diligent 3 Investigative Solutions approach, really allow a compliance professional to be able to pivot to a different region if required?
Oh, yes, for sure. I think a lot of these allow for that. It's a little bit more global in the way that we're looking at it, is it's not as country specific. And obviously, we're looking at them in that country and what their ownership is, but it's not do it in this country because that's more concern. And I think which investigative solution you use also probably depends on just how high risk and what that relationship looks like. And some of that is dictated kind of by their location as well.
Jen, could we move to the next slide? China. All things China. I cannot think of a more challenging defined geographic area, even more than Mexico, than China. And part of that challenge is the dynamic relationship, trade war, trade conflict, whatever we may choose to call it, the United States is currently having with China. We seem to be moving a little smoother right now after the president's visit to the China. That might change, and that might change this afternoon. But let's start off with, what do you see as some of the compliance challenges in China?
Yeah, I think one of the big challenges is, like you said, as far as like the region and things, there's a lot of different regulations that apply, and they raise China as a risk by itself in so many of these. So we just talked about BIS, and China is one of those that comes up on a lot of those export controls. There's a lot of China entities on the entity list. The military end users list is almost entirely, if not entirely, Chinese entities. So there's a lot of risks associated with China. And if I may, I'm just going to kind of roll into a compliance gap potentially with that, which is also the accessibility of information. So a lot of information in China is hard to get to as well, or it's not as available outside of China, or it's a lot of state-controlled information as well. So are you really getting into some of those risks and things like that? And so I think when you're thinking about all of these different risk factors and how do you address them, I think a big compliance gap is when you're trying to address one and not addressing another one because you still have a gap over here on this other one. And so it's almost, and your brain could go 100 different ways trying to figure out, how do I put all of these things together? Because it's okay, do I worry about this or do I worry about that? And how do I fit all of these things together? And I think that's just what creates a compliance gap because it's just complex.
And then how about a tiered approach? You've mentioned the compliance gap, and certainly I think most compliance professionals are aware of the difficulty in getting certain types of information. How can a tiered approach really help specifically regarding China?
Yes. So I think one of the things is if you really looked at your China third parties, and when I say third parties, I'm including your vendors, your end users, everybody that can kind of fit into that category. And if you were to look at them and say, okay, if I put them in different places to say, what am I most concerned about? And especially then say, where is my level of risk and my risk tolerance, depending on what they're doing on our behalf, things like that, right? So when you take all of these things and you put them together, making a tiered approach to your due diligence in China allows you to start to just funnel them all into these different tiers. And so when you start at your baseline, which is like our open source investigation, this would be your lower risk, where you don't need quite as much information. You're not really worried about as many of the higher risk scenarios. And this is going to give you a lot of that business standing and business operations. It's going to give you a lot of the anti-bribery, anti-corruption risks, things like that. Then when you're in situations where you need something that has a little bit more of the official records, like you really need to verify some information on these third parties, then you can go into some of our OSI Plus solutions, where we have a few different solutions where we're pulling official records. Now, the highlight for me is one of our new due diligence offerings, where we have taken a lot of these different risks that all apply to China, and we've put them all into one little package of, we call it China Risk Research. And in this one, we've taken the things that are like human rights and environmental risks. So in China, we're dealing with the UFLPA as a US regulation in China. You're also looking at globally any kind of human rights and environmental concerns. Those both are risks in China. You have data security issues that you may be facing in China. And then you have all of your normal anti-bribery, anti-corruption, and you have that military end use. And that's a lot of things for me to rattle off. And I'm sure that you're thinking, how are you doing that all in one thing? So we really focused this report on those. There's a lot of adverse finding categories in that report, so that we're really focusing on all of these risk areas. But then we also have some of those official records adding into that for like registration and things like that. And we're looking at the depth of ownership as well. So we're pulling in that ownership component and looking at those owners. A big thing in China is a lot of entities are somehow linked to the government or military in some way, a lot of times through multiple levels of different ownership. And so if you're really trying to assess some of those risks, and especially like military end use risk, or you're government relationship risks, you need that component in there as well. You need to know how this ownership ultimately relates back to a government or a military.
Wow, what a package. Let me ask you, you detailed several different categories of risks in this specific package. Does that allow your customer slash client the ability to not only assess specific risk with great specificity, but also deliver a risk management solution if appropriate?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the nice things is that it gives you that documentation that you need for a lot of these regulations. They're always looking at the, do you have it documented? And it gives you that documentation. And one nice thing is you get it in one thing. You're not having to do five different investigations and try to put them all together and show how, okay, in the totality of all of these different ones, this is how we came to this conclusion about this third party. You've got it all in one, and it's documented in that one particular thing. And I think if you build that into your larger compliance program when it comes to China third parties, you're really, it's going to help you to kind of say, okay, when we know we have one, that we have concerns in all of these different areas, this is definitely one place where then you can really assess that and really feel like in one place, I'm looking at one document and it's telling me those things. And the one that I didn't mention in the tiered approach goes one step further, and that's our enhanced due diligence. And that provides even, it's that next level that includes reputation checks, and where we have field investigators going and actually talking to people about the company. In China, sometimes that is the key to actually getting some negative information, and that you're not going to find just in the media necessarily. And that's key, as well as the site operations. They go there, they actually see, are they operating here? What kind of building and facility is it? Things like that, which with some of the other regulations and export controls and things like that, it also helps to know that it's, you know where that address is, you know the type of building, and say you go there and it's a building that's owned by one of these entities that is, you know, on the entity list, or maybe that address is on the entity list since there are addresses there now. So it gives you that extra, okay, what are the surroundings and how do we look at that? So it gives you just like that even extra step of looking at their operation.
Stephanie, let me change the focus just a little bit from delivering a, if not answer, a series of information to your client to what happens if a regulator comes knocking. Can the client print a report? Can the customer or client show the regulator, this is what we did, this was the methodology that was used, here's the results we had, because I got to talk about document, because what do you do if a regulator shows up? Is that a part of the solution as well?
So the key with due diligence reports is they are always documents. And so that is where you take from a tech solution where you're screening and you might have it in your system and you can show it there. The due diligence investigations are always documents. And so at least for documentation, you can show, and we have within the report itself, we have a research protocol, which typically outlines some of the key components, any limitations as far as the research that goes into it and things like that. And that also can help with that documentation. The other thing that I would say is, especially when it comes to implementing new things like the new China risk research scope, is make sure that's documented in your program as far as, well, which entities are you going to use that scope for, right? So that if a regulator is looking and they want to go see, how do you decide when you're going to do that? You need to actually document that part of your process to say what leads to you deciding whether you're going to do an OSI or you're going to do China risk research or you're going to go all the way to an EDD. And how are you deciding? That decision-making should also be documented.
Jen, can we move to our next slide, please? So we've got another polling question. And here I really wanted to get a sense of whether the audience is looking at China, whether you're doing business China, et cetera. And are you still doing business in or with China? Does the UFLPA apply to you in any way? Are you looking at that? A couple of other questions. Do you cover transshipping in your export control? For my sins, once upon a time, I was appointed an export control director at an oilfield service company. And so I learned about transshipping. And this could be a critical area around countries that are prohibited, such as Iran, Russia, obviously Cuba and North Korea. But and then do you have an end user certificate program, and how often do you review that? Because I had export control directors who got end user certificates for all of the parts that we sold, whether they were new or used. So we're going to leave this for a few moments until we get some results. Stephanie, are really any of these areas things that you would say are more critical from your perspective?
I could see a lot of these being all of the above as something, but I think that one of the things with the export controls and the BIS is the end user certificate program is I definitely think that having documentation with those the end users or with whoever you're shipping to as far as who is the end user, I think is important. And early this year, there was an arrest made of someone who purchased semiconductors. No, not semiconductors. That was a different one. But accelerometers from a U.S. company. And they did not declare the correct end user on purpose, but then they were reshipping essentially those same things onto China. And it would have required a license that they didn't have. And the company that sold them to them, they asked for the end user information. So it's an interesting kind of piece where it's if you're doing that goes back to some of that documentation as well, right? Because you've asked, you've had them declare, you have certain documentation from them. And then what they do and they take and they go from there, it at least mitigates some of your own circumstances when you've at least taken those steps.
So some very interesting answers here. It looks a lot of folks are looking at transshipping appropriately. We have nearly 30%, Stephanie, who are still doing business in or with China, which certainly is going to present its own set of challenges. Have an end user certificate program, and then somehow they fall under the UFLPA. So it looks like China is a big part of a lot of users' business going forward. Can we move to the next slide, Jen? Okay. This was an area that was frankly new to me. So I'm going to have to rely on you about the DOJ and the national security requirement. Can I start by asking you, Stephanie, what is the DOJ National Security Division data security program?
Yes, to relate it to export controls, but in a different way, so just kind of thinking of it in a slightly different way, is it's almost like the export of personal data. So this is instead of you're loading an item on a ship and it's going somewhere in the physical sense, in this case, it's talking about personal data. And so what this was set up to do is to protect personal and government data from the US and US people from getting in the hands of those who may misuse it and could then create a risk of national security risk if it's government data, but also identity theft. I don't know if that really comes into play, but definitely different ways that people's personal data could ultimately be used by others and used to manipulate things and things like that. So they were looking really at that. So they put in this data security program. There are countries of concern, and no surprise, probably, but just to link it back, one of those countries happens to be China. So recurring theme here, but they have this list of countries. Most of them are the same that we're used to seeing over and over. And if the data, so the way that it kind of works is like if any of your vendors have access to personal data. So maybe they're a data processor for you or something like that. And then you need to know where are they operating. And then there's a whole component of the data security program that also involves where are their owners located. So here we go again with ownership as well as another risk area. And really what it's looking at is do the risk of sharing data, that data ultimately ends up in one of those countries of concern. And so that's why it's ownership, it's their operations, things like that, as far as how do you meet that.
So how do you think through these requirements and how do you counsel clients or customers around this?
So I would say your first step has to be to really focus and identify which one of your vendors and third parties have access to personal data through you. So maybe it's your customer data, maybe they're one of your software providers and they're in your system and things like that. And they have, whether that's employee data or customer data, any kind of personal data, or maybe if you're a government supplier, do they have access within systems that have sensitive government data? And so first you need to pare it down because you don't need to look at your whole entire set. It's really those that have some kind of access to personal or government data. So when you get that list, then you need to determine where do they operate. So where's their headquarters? Where are they? Or where's their primary operating location is really what it's looking for. And then if none of those are, say, in any countries of concern, that's great. However, then you need to know, do any of their owners operate in those locations? Interestingly enough, they also have a 50% rule embedded into the data security program. So if you have owners located in countries of concern that hold at least 50% of the ownership in your vendor, then you also have the same like risks associated. Now, the risk mitigation piece from the program is kind of multifaceted in the sense that in some cases it may be like you may not want to use them, but in other cases it's really more of a documentation. You have a strong data security policy and program. You put them through designated training or things like that. You have certificates or specific policies, things that they have to sign or acknowledge, things like that to help mitigate that. And so I think there's a lot, it's kind of more like, how do you mitigate the concerns once you know that information?
And what's the diligent research solution around this area, Stephanie?
Yeah, so we've taken a unique approach that's a little bit different than our standard due diligence investigations on this one. And our approach on this one is looking at it more as a portfolio assessment. So when you've taken that first step and identified this is our set of third parties that have access to sensitive data, then taking those, and we work with you to say, okay, which which parts of the data security program are you the most concerned about? And then we will look at their owners, multi-level ownership, and identify if they are located in countries of concern. We highlight that information for you, and we do that calculation to say if you've met that 50% of countries in concern. But we do it as a portfolio. So you kind of give us that list that says, hey, here's our vendor list that has that access. We look up those owners and their locations. We also have the option that we can look at subsidiaries. The data security program mentions subsidiaries, but it's more in the risk assessment rather than a strong requirement necessarily, but it is an indication of where they operate and where potentially they could be sharing data. And you have to at least be kind of assessing that level of risk. So we can do subsidiaries and do the same thing where we're looking at their countries of concern. And then we also have another piece that we can add on where we do research into more of the adverse information behind data security. So do they have some accusations out there about not having the data security practices? Maybe they've had data breaches, things like that. And these, so the way that we're doing this is more as like a project where you can say, okay, I just need the owners and I need to know where they're located. Okay, that's one aspect. We do it as a full list of them at once. And so we work with you in terms of how many is that and what does that look like? And then you have the options of doing also identifying subsidiaries, also adding in that adverse information. But we're looking at it more in that sense. And then one of our recommendations, though, is that when you get all of that information from us and you have those owners and things, is that then you put them into your third-party risk management platform. So for us, like the third-party manager, and be able to actually put them in there, set them up for continuous monitoring. The National Security Program says there will be a covered persons list. There hasn't been one yet because they define covered persons as any individuals and entities operating one of these countries of concern, but they reserve the right to create a list so that they can address people that are, say, outside of those countries of concern, but that they, through relationships or other risks, have identified that they may also be at risk in this case. And so at whatever point in time they start publishing names on a covered persons list, you would want to have some level of continuous monitoring to know if names started to appear on that list.
Stephanie, why act now?
So why right now is because the data security program's due diligence requirement just went into effect on October 6th of this year. So now you have that requirement if you have personal data that you are sharing with vendors.
Jen, can we move to our next slide? We're going to end by sort of wrapping up why we, both Stephanie and I, see change as ubiquitous moving forward into 2026. But Jen, could I ask if any questions have come in that we could answer before we get to this last slide? Okay, being a lawyer, hearing none, I will assume there are no questions. We both believe that you need to be ready for change. I try to articulate having a process in place. But Stephanie, I wanted to ask, what's an actionable step that a compliance professional who either is an attendee today or someone who listens to this on recorded can take to modernize their export control program?
So I think one key step is, especially this time of year and headed into 2026, make sure that your budget is allowing for that space for the expansion of these different requirements. So what your normal due diligence or third-party screening budget is, make sure that you've made some room to expand that in 2026 and to be able to vary up some of your options. I think that's one definite actionable step right now because a lot of people are working on their budgets to prepare for next year. So now is a good time to make sure that you've accounted for that. And the other is make sure that export controls are part of your broader compliance program as far as it's not just a general screening. Make sure that you are looking at all of the different export controls that now you're facing. Make sure that they're built into that broader compliance program.
I hope we haven't overwhelmed our listeners so far, but if they are overwhelmed, how do you suggest they maybe start to break these down into some components that are more bite-sized to chew on, Stephanie?
Yeah, absolutely. I think start with your high risk or your high priority areas. So if you've got a really good foundation in your ABAC program, it's probably a good place to launch from to say, hey, we've got a good program here. How do we just incorporate some of these other things? But in terms of the additional research and things that you need, start with those higher risk locations or relationships or the industries and the types of materials that they may be handling, and start your focus there. Because if you make sure that you've got your higher risk, you can start to trickle down your program from there.
And you started off with a phrase, I wish I had named this webinar, and that phrase was, who else? Our last question here is, if there's one area of the program most ready for reinvention, and I want to tie that back into who else, could the reinvention actually even be a mind shift that compliance professionals need to make to really literally that exact phrase, who else?
Yes, I love that. I think almost like a compliance cultural change to start to say, instead of saying sticking as strictly to what we're used to, is who else should we be considering? Who else should we be looking at? Even the what else should we be thinking about?
Can we go to the next slide, Jen? This next slide just is, this is the money slide because it summarizes everything that we've talked about. But we've had a question come in, Stephanie, from our audience that I think is not only prescient, but may even be pretty difficult to answer. So I'll just read it. With all the tit for tat with China, what's the best compliance posture with regard to regulatory instability? And I'll go first because I believe it's process. I believe that by having a robust process, you're able to respond to regulatory instability, regulatory change, more dynamic change, a pullback of change, whatever that might be, but it's really in a process. And so with that, I'll pitch it over to you, Stephanie, and get your thoughts on that question.
I think you're definitely right. I think the process, and I think if you've got your structure there, however the regulations kind of ebb and flow a little bit, having that structure and just showing that you have made the attempts to do the different various risk assessments involved, then even as they shift, you can shift too. But as long as you're documenting your approach the entire time, then you also have that backing as things change and just making room for those changes.
So I'm going to ask our audience if there is any final questions. This really has been, I've learned so much from you, Stephanie. I want to thank you. I'm sure our audience has as well. We have one final poll to ask. What would be some of the biggest challenges you may have going forward? Trade sanctions involving sanctions countries, recognizing that those sanctioned countries could expand pretty quickly. Economic sanctions against FTOs and almost certainly around cartels and those who are doing business with cartels. Number three, convincing management to continue investment in your export controls. Stephanie spoke specifically around that. And then strengthening the governance and oversight structure. So we'll take a few minutes for this final question, Stephanie.
Do you have any thoughts? What do you think is one of the biggest challenges, Tom?
For me, it's governance and oversight structures because that's the process baked in there. So in the process guide, try to talk about that. But really each one of these, I hope the management of your company has now understood the really significant nature of export control. Many export control directors are talking to the boards literally for the first time ever over the past couple of years. And I hope management will continue to see not only the need, but the power, the business justification and rationale for an investment in export controls. With economic sanctions against FTOs, that's directly in who else and what else. And then sanctioned countries, who's going to be sanctioned this afternoon, next month, in Q1 of 2026. So, wow, strengthening governance and oversight structures, rock on process. And then trade sanctions involving sanctioned countries. So with that, can we go to the final slide? Okay, I wanted to thank you. Any final thoughts, Stephanie, before we sign off?
I know this was a lot of information. We talked about a lot of things, and I think a lot of it really intersects, but most definitely reach out and ask if you're not sure what to do or where you need to go or what type of due diligence or screening that you need, reach out and we can have this conversation and really start to work on what helps you and how you can build that into your program.
All right. I wanted to thank everyone for attending. I wanted to thank Stephanie and Jen, our host, being a wonderful hostess for this webinar. And we look forward to visiting with you again for our next webinar. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The FCPA Compliance Report is the longest running podcast in compliance, having been founded in 2012. Finally, I hope you'll check out my latest podcast, AI Today in 5, where I look at 5 stories of AI and compliance literally every day of the week. I know you'll enjoy this new podcast. I hope you will join us again next week, where I will be joined by Stephanie Font to take a look at the expansion of due diligence to a new category of parties through export controls and sanctions and the redesignation of cartels as foreign terrorist organizations.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.